Hospital ID Theft, Double Entry 666. In 1998, Dr. David Post, a forensic psychiatrist in Jackson, Louisiana, suggested that German neuropsychologist Edmund Forster could have hypnotically induced Adolf Hitler's recovery from hysterical blindness at Pazewalk Military Hospital. Psychohistorian Dr. Rudolf Binion held the same opinion and also cited a 1939 book, Der Augenzeuge, The Eyewitness, by Ernst Weiss, a Jewish doctor who knew Forster and fled Nazi Germany. It is a fictionalized account of Hitler's mustard gas miracle cure. Even so, fiction is not authenticity. Since Hitler's Pazewalk hospital records were seized and Dr. Forster died under mysterious circumstances, maybe it's not useful to rely on a vague war novel that could have forged a propaganda genre to back Hitler's so-called hypnosis remedy, for which there has never been conclusive proof. Similarly, according to a 2008 summary in the Sun newspaper, German war doctor Johann Jammer saved Adolf Hitler's life in 1916. As supposedly passed on by Blas Suess Hank Chuch, a friend of Jammer, Hitler was injured in the abdomen and lost one testicle in the Battle of the Somme. As rumor had it, the doctor kept Hitler's injury a secret until he finally revealed it on his deathbed to a priest in the 1960s, see pages 395-6. But why didn't the German doctor come forward with his monarchistic bombshell when authorities were trying to identify Hitler's corpse from the Chancellery Garden? Or during the Nuremberg trials? Maybe Dr. Jammer was a hush-hush sympathizer, in which case his surprising tale could be a bogus pretext to divulge another unspoken Nazi miracle. It's only a scratch, said the superhuman combatant to the war doctor. Who needs sick pay? Let's not even report it. Variant lyrics of a popular song supposedly written by Toby O'Brien eventually appeared as British propaganda. Hitler has only got one ball. Goering has two but very small. Himmler is somewhat similar. But Goebbels has no balls at all. Sensibly, forensic psychiatrists need to branch out from fictionalized accounts with a laboratory breakdown of what mustard gas, epirite, actually does to the human body. It is one of the most deadly of all poisonous chemicals, and sudden recovery is not to be expected. Psychohistorians should also distinguish in the present day that medical centers are major locations for identity theft, also known as impersonation fraud. Stories of nurses, patients, and visitors stealing identities from the sick can be ripped from the headlines across America, like the story of a nurse in a Philadelphia hospital who gave terminally ill patients' identities to a crime ring. They drained the patients' accounts and obtained $10 million in fraudulent mortgages using the stolen personal information. They're like vultures. You wonder how people can be so horrible, said Mari Frank, an ID theft victim lawyer and author of two books on the subject. They think, who cares, he's going to die anyway. Bob Sullivan, Hospital ID Theft, MSNBC, December 23, 2005. The American poet E.E. Cummings was an ambulance driver in World War I and picked up injured soldiers. Because comments about crimes of war were found in the letters of a friend, he was arrested on suspicion of espionage and sent to a military detention camp. Cummings's mishaps in the camp were told in his 1922 novel, The Enormous Room. At least 22 other well-known literary figures, including Ernest Hemingway and Walt Disney, operated ambulances at the end of World War I. On the last day of World War I, a big ambulance stopped in front of a German army medical wing. Infirmary workers were packing up their belongings and finally going home. Germany had surrendered. Outside, vandals with wheelbarrows looted unlocked doorways of the hospital. But the visitors who arrived by car were agents of a different plunder, the unclaimed dead, or in this case, the almost dead. The sanatorium doctor was pleased to learn that a Tavistock association without delay would assume all responsibility for the Iron Cross respirator patient. That young soldier never had letters or visitors. Those nearest to him most likely could not afford the cost of a mechanical ventilator. When will he be walking again? The chauffeur bluntly asked. His eyesight is coming back, the neuropsychologist replied. but I'm not sure he can walk, although he might be able to sit up for a few hours. His lungs are seriously injured with edema and hemorrhage. Can he sit up and paint a picture? The bald gentleman leading the chauffeur butted in. They believed it could be very useful for their philanthropic association. The doctor watched with inquisitiveness as tubing and oxygen cylinders designed by George Poe, Jr. were removed along with the semi-conscious patient, wrapped in a bedspread. The artificial respirator of the early 1900s, known as safety breathing armor, was as big as a piano. But the sanatorium doctor would not stay alive long enough to talk about that uncommon incident. His medical files would be robbed. A few hours later, a whiff of petrol delayed two men in a garage. "My magic child is an inmate who never tries to escape," the hairless man spoke sympathetically and glanced at a photograph in his hand. "I'll spend much time beside his bed." "What luck, like winning a dice game," the chauffeur opened his door with a grin. "A miracle." "Yes, Julian," the bald gentleman whispered. "A miracle cure came to pass the Rubicon on this day. It shall transcend every history book and forbear dominion of the world." Most onlookers concede that a chauffeur or stenographer might have been the political decoy of Adolf Hitler. But when a modern Satanist is suggested, some find it extremely unnerving to acknowledge, even though Nazism was stubbornly polluted with occult and magical ceremonies. Luckily, face recognition algorithms operate more exactly than humans, since they aren't partial to confirmation bias or the tendency to notice what verifies one's beliefs and ignore what disagrees with them. Some brash critics imagine that a strategy of decoy politics would directly have been exposed, causing the Third Reich to somehow collapse. Yet, analytical news reports that departed terrorist Osama bin Laden made use of a video double clearly did not bring his Al-Qaeda network to a halt. Earlier than bin Laden, the Nazi dictator was a staged figurehead, a show persona played by at least four decoys, and his looks loosely shifted. Medical identity theft is growing rapidly today. According to the World Privacy Forum, over 500,000 Americans have by now become victims of medical identity theft. Keeping a physically incapacitated look-alike could accomplish two objectives for in-the-flesh impersonation fraud. First, to be able to interrogate the doppelganger on demand and extract any relevant information about that person's life, including other people's names, past activities, and special experiences worth citing. Second, if a subsequent criminal act went wrong, the look-alike could be held responsible and eliminated in a way resembling suicide. The real lawbreaker would be free to escape unnoticed with a blameless identity. Historians question whether Adolf Hitler and Aleister Crowley actually did meet in the course of Hitler's miracle cure at Pazewalk Hospital. At the end of World War I, Crowley unexpectedly went missing from New York during the summer of 1918 on a magical retreat to Aesopus Island, and did not turn up in England again until the next year. While in America, Crowley unflinchingly proposed collecting a large number of photographs, full face and profile for each subject, and classifying them according to the horoscope. To other occultists, such a photo experiment would have been for the educated astrologer to adopt scientific methods of study. But it would have also been a very ingenious way for a schemer of in-the-flesh impersonation fraud to hunt for his doppelganger. The labor required for this research would be enormous, but the bulk of it would be done by ordinary clerks. And as for the preliminary difficulty of collecting material, any great newspaper could carry out the scheme easily enough. It would of course be necessary to publish an explanation of the proposal with a questionnaire covering the principal points, and asking for good photographs to be sent with the filled-up form. The Confessions of Aleister Crowley. Police and military intelligence files are better mugshot sources than a newspaper survey. According to Crowley, Professor Hugo Munsterberg of Harvard University was the wartime secret director of German propaganda in America. Crowley went to great lengths to patronize Munsterberg and even volunteered to collect and report information for Germany and the Central Powers of World War I. The professor had the great German gift of being always right. "My task was simplified, I had merely to keep on telling him how very right he was. Possibly hundreds of photographs of German residents may have been classified and studied to find Crowley's look-alike. Certainly, the beast's double had to be someone who closely resembled him in the flesh. But Crowley also needed a look-alike with a clean police and service record, maybe even a soldier noted for daring on the front line. He also needed someone single, an unknown loner living far enough away from any family members or friends who might otherwise notice the switchover. But most important, he needed someone who was morally innocent, a virgin. The magic child would be the ritual sacrificial victim or foundational guinea pig for Crowley's new occult religion. The motives that determined the policy of Crowley's political actions would be kept secret. The magic child would be forced to forfeit his identity and, if the great beast had his way, even his soul. For the highest spiritual working one must accordingly choose that victim which contains the greatest and purest force. A male child of perfect innocence and high intelligence. It is the sacrifice of oneself spiritually. And the intelligence and innocence of that male child are the perfect understanding of the magician, his one aim, without lust of result. And male he must be, because what he sacrifices is not the material blood, but his creative power. Aleister Crowley. To explain Adolf Hitler's anti-Semitism, some historians believed that while in Vienna, young Hitler had a passionate fling with an unnamed Jewish prostitute. She supposedly transmitted a disease to him and ignited Hitler's hatred towards Jews. But that account has never been established. Persons acquainted with Hitler during his stay in Vienna's youth hostels did not portray him as a philanderer who flirted or had salacious affairs. In contrast, Aleister Crowley used racial bigotry to torment his Jewish homosexual partner Victor Neuberg in a sadomasochistic affair, according to Lawrence Sutton. Crowley leveled numerous brutal verbal attacks on Neuberg's family and Jewish ancestry. He also defended the use of violence against ethnic lower classes and applied the term nigger to Africans, Indians, and Italians. While in America, Crowley pursued a magical makeover of religious fundamentalism and supportively took notice of the Ku Klux Klan. Crowley's anti-Semitism so troubled his editors that Israel Regardi tried to hold back a malicious piece of writing about Jewish mystics. Science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard may have guessed that Crowley's magic child was a brain in a vat recipe that entailed organ trafficking like Oliver Haddo in Somerset Maugham's The Magician, 1908. Hubbard taught an inventive self-help system called Dianetics, stressing individual human rights. His clique's Church of Scientology has been accused of spying. The magic child sat motionless, his right arm strapped to the armrest of a wooden chair. He could not move. That would be the worst thing to do. Fierce conditioning had taught him the vital difference between good and evil. Sitting still was good, any form of movement was evil. It took him time to accept his new code of ethics, this exacting system of values between right and wrong. By now, the new rule had formed a direct, unnatural union with the deepest part of his instincts. What did we say about eye movements? A low and harsh voice uttered judgment from dense shadows of the bunker. Vapors of tobacco smoke spread through the stale air. It was a trick. The magic child knew he hadn't moved his eyes. He had kept his gaze fixed on the ugly mark on the wall before him since the session began. Nothing had moved. He knew the annoying voice was but another trick to anger him, to make him protest, to make him move, and be evil. The back of his head ached. But he could not express pain. That would cause eye movement, and be evil. He was not able to see the area where a surgical drill had bored a small opening into his skull, splattering blood on the wall behind him. Nor could he see a thin electrode horn of wires leading into the hole of exposed brain tissue. He could only feel his difficult situation. And he could smell. Vapors of tobacco smoke stroked his wounds. The guards of the bunker had planned their experiments with imposing detail. When, for instance, the day would come to terminate this guinea pig, it would appear to the world that the magic child had shot himself in the head. No one would ever suspect that a gunshot wound concealed the spot where his nervous system once functioned as the central processing unit of the world's ultimate war machine. This was the best-kept secret. He was their unknown soldier, the living Atla, and Titanic Superman of Nietzsche, driven insane. This is your war, the harsh voice promised, followed by a diabolic spasm of laughter behind a sour mist of smoke. The magic child ignored the harassment. Instead, he concentrated on being good, no movement, no thought, perfectly still. He had laboriously learned that his eye movements were being electronically monitored. Charted on a plotter and superimposed over a map of the world. If he made the mistake of glancing to his left, rockets would fall near Britain. That would be evil. If he looked to his right, air attacks would occur toward Russia. Evil again. In time, he learned that his only good task was to look straight ahead at Jerusalem, and remain absolutely still. These were lightning tactics, the blitzkrieg of a swift new warfare, the guards boasted. And his intuitive, instinctive impulses would overcome and control the world for them. "These are your battles," the menacing voice declared with pride. "How does it feel?" The magic child's neck and shoulders became tense. Something evil was about to happen. "How does it feel?" He reasoned to himself with a frantic desire to scream. He aroused his horror to confront the issue. "How does it feel to know that a blink of my eye brings death to thousands? Do I like it?" he wondered with anxiety, fear, and pain. A nervous finger suddenly twitched and he glanced downward without intention. A great evil had just occurred. Was it really involuntary, without his will? Or did a dark part of his injured psyche actually take pleasure in this course of destruction? The magic child knew he would receive full knowledge of his evil act in the morning. Newspapers would be read aloud to him. The superfluous suffering, the unnecessary deaths. His name would be on front pages. A fresh pile of blazing newspapers would, as usual, be dropped on the bunker floor near his chair, burnt offering for him to eat. In the autumn of 2009, a veteran intelligence operative, reactivated into defense agency programs, walked through the old world streets of an eastern Mediterranean city. He gazed down and visualized structures deep under the pavement, to look into the past. As the world prepared for the 1936 Berlin Summer Olympic Games, the levels beneath this pavement were upgraded with electricity and water conduits by a Bavarian street building society, Charter of Athens, 1933. The Stavridis Committee assignment of the German architects Leo von Klenze and Albert Speer constructed an underground shelter site here. By a narrow road named Merlin was the Balkan headquarters of the Gestapo. The Nazi Schutzstaffel, SS, took over the Hotel Grande Bretagne. The security mentor paced the walkway of what he called the bunker to solve a puzzle full of history. In the past, he had performed groundbreaking experiments with remote exploration. Now, enormously behind him, a funicular tunnel of steel tracks drew railway carriages by cable through the base of Mount Lycabettus and up to its peak. It offered a convincing display that the ancient city of Athens was hollow within. A series of complex bunkers deep inside the rock face installation encircled a subterranean engine that powered a cabled hoisting machine. Like the exotic Berghof elevator, the Grecian construction inspired by Bavarian masons and architects was suggestive of Nazi Germany's suspected national southern redoubt, an inner stronghold from which Germany would retaliate. The Allies, who later said the redoubt fortress existed mostly in the German imagination, searched for Nazi atomic weapon sites near the Mediterranean. Here, defended by nature and by the most efficient secret weapons yet invented, the powers that have hitherto guided Germany will survive to reorganize her resurrection. Here armaments will be manufactured in bomb-proof factories, food and equipment will be stored in vast underground caverns and a specially selected corpus of young men will be trained in guerrilla warfare, so that a whole underground army can be fitted and directed to liberate Germany from occupying forces. Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, Weekly Intelligence Summary, March 11, 1945. In his mind's eye, the intelligence guardian pictured dugout walls, and the slab of a radiation shield with an airlock that opened like a submarine door. In the bunker, the center of attention was a chair with a hole marked in its seat. Next to it was a pile of scorched newspapers from the 1940s with articles about the Nazis. A blood-spattered mattress carpeted part of the floor. Who made use of the underground shelter in World War II? Was it for secret interrogations and psychophysical experiments? Details of the Athens bunker and the Berlin decoy photographs matched very well but shouldn't have, because they were almost 2,000 kilometers apart. Were they just coincidences?